Okay, good morning. As you know, this morning we're not going to be doing the normal Bible study. Instead, we're going to be talking about the afterlife, which was requested last time. So we're going to take a break and we will resume next time with Genesis chapter 24. For next time, we're going to be doing Genesis chapter 24, at least begin on it. We won't do the whole chapter. But this time, we're going to be talking about Jewish ideas of the afterlife, and I want to recommend to you two books. One of them I know is out of print, the other one I'm not sure. The more comprehensive of the two is called Jewish Views of the Afterlife by Simcha Paul Raphael. And again, it's called Jewish Views of the Afterlife. You can look on Amazon or Al Libris or A Books to see for out-of-print books. And the other is written by Neil Gilman, who is a professor at the Jewish Theological Seminary, called The Death of Death. Okay? The Death of Death is the more readable of the two. The other one is not unreadable, but it's more comprehensive. It takes you into areas that may be of less immediate interest. Neil Gilman's book not only gives you the central beliefs, but also in the end tries to help you figure out what you believe. Does the Soul Survive by Elie Spitz is a good book, but it's about resurrection primarily. It's not about the afterlife all in general, although it's certainly worth taking a look at. Elie Spitz, if you read that book, you'll see, I think my name is on it on the back. So yeah, so I read it at some point. But you'll see that he was very influenced by Brian, what's his name's book, Many Lives, Many Masters. Since people said I love that book, I won't talk about that book. However, it is, for those of you who are interested in a very interesting presentation of the idea of reincarnation, which is what Elie Spitz's book is about, reincarnation, Many Lives, Many Masters is a very interesting and compelling look at reincarnation. It's a very easy read, and for those of you who are convinced by it, it is convincing. I'm taking a leaf there from Gertrude Stein, who called Ezra Pound the village explainer, and she said, which is good if you're a village, but if not, not. Anyway, but Many Lives, Many Masters is certainly a worthwhile book to read, as I said, Rabbi Spitz, who is a friend of mine, a wonderful guy and an outstanding rabbi, was very moved by that book and has his own exploration of reincarnation in his book, Does the Soul Survive? Okay, so there is our little bibliographical introduction. Now let's get to the substance of the subject. And let's begin by, and I'm going to, I think, probably talk for a while and then take questions. But I want to begin by looking at what the Bible itself has to say about the afterlife. And the short answer is precious little. You would assume that the Bible would talk a lot about what happens after you die, but in fact, it barely discusses it at all, and it seems, when it does, to be ambiguous, except for one or two passages. There are people, for example, who do not seem to die. It says Enosh walked with God. Never says Enosh died. And more famously, who doesn't die in the Bible? Elijah, which is why Elijah is the one who's going to come back to announce the coming of the Messiah. Because if you don't die, you have a better shot of coming back. So Elijah goes up to heaven in a whirlwind in a chariot and drops his cloak so that his successor, Elisha, can take over from him, but he himself does not die. Elijah it's never stated that Elijah lives on anywhere else. But the rabbis, who, as I will come to in a moment, deeply believed in an afterlife, looked throughout the Bible for clues that an afterlife was real. And so you get, for example, and here is the most... Here's the most explicit story. I mentioned it last week, but now I'm going to read it to you, at least part of it, of an afterlife in the Bible. And that's the story of the witches of Endor. Saul goes out the night before he's to be killed in battle, and he goes disguised to a witch. The reason he's disguised is, first of all, because it got Hillary Clinton in a lot of trouble when she consulted with an astrologer, if you recall. And it's not good for kings to be seen asking for, what's that?
Nancy Reagan,
I'm sorry. Oh no, Hillary Clinton made a comment about it though, that she also consults an astrologer. Nancy Reagan had like a court astrologer. Hillary Clinton said she also consults one. But it gets you in trouble because people think, not a question of whether it's reasonable or not, but people are worried when kings don't know that things are gonna go well. But also, Saul had issued a decree against anybody going to witches. So he disguised himself, he goes, and then the woman says, "Whom shall I bring up for you?" He answered, "Bring Samuel up for me." Samuel had just died. The woman recognized Samuel, and she shrieked loudly and said to Saul, "Why have you deceived me? You are Saul." The king answered, "Don't be afraid. What do you see?" The woman said to Saul, "I see a divine being coming up from the earth. What does he look like?" "It's an old man coming up," she said, "and he's wrapped in a robe." Then Saul knew it was Samuel. He bowed low with homage to the ground, and Samuel said to Saul, "Why have you disturbed me and brought me up?" Okay, then they have a little dialogue, and Samuel basically says, "It's all over for you," and Saul leaves, and in fact, it is all over for him. But that's just about the only real picture we have of someone coming back. And for the most part, the Bible talks about the afterlife as Sheol, which is this shadowy underworld that is not explicit and is not explained, and it's not at all clear what it means to go to Sheol. Not only is it not clear, but you could easily make the case, as some biblical scholars do, that the Bible had no clear idea of the afterlife, which is why it's not talked about. Now, we'll make other cases about that too, but at least you should know that, for example, you have the following verse in Ecclesiastes, right, Kohelet. "For in respect to the fate of man and the fate of beast, they have one and the same fate. As one dies, so dies the other. Both have the same life breath. Man has no superiority over beast, since both amount to nothing. Both go to the same place. Both come from dust and return to dust. Who knows if a man's life breath rises upward and a beast sinks downward into the earth?" Which at the most optimistic reading you could give here is he thinks maybe it's vaguely possible that human beings live on, but he clearly doesn't endorse that view. And remember, I'm not reading to you from some medieval rabbi, I'm reading to you from the Bible. So you can see that it is unclear what exactly it means, but in the same book of Kohelet, which is as self-contradictory and fascinating a book as has ever been written, it says at the very end of the book, "The dust returns to the ground as it was, and the life breath returns to God who bestowed it." So who knows? You can argue it both ways. Which means that the foundational book of the Bible allowed for people who saw death in different ways to accept that there were different ways of seeing death. But it's not just the individual, because there really are, I would say, four separate ideas that we have to explore here in order to get some sense of what the afterlife is like in Judaism. One is the soul. Allied to that is the idea of reincarnation. I'm not going to do these in the order I'm saying them, but the soul, reincarnation, resurrection, that is physical bodily resurrection, which we will get to in just a moment, in the book of Daniel especially, and finally, the Messiah. Because the Messiah has a lot to do with all this, because remember, in the Messianic age, a lot of this is supposed to happen, right? That's why people want to be buried in Israel, as we will come to in a moment. Let's start with the rabbinic ideas about this. In Pirkei Avot, which is the Ethics of the Fathers, a foundational rabbinic work from the Mishnah, it says, Rabbi Yaakov says it, "Preferable is 1 hour of repentance and good deeds in this world than an eternity in the world to come." Okay? Which tells you one of two things. Either this world can be really great, or the world to come is not so great. Yeah. Because imagine saying that 1 hour of repentance and good deeds is better in this world than the entirety of the world to come. Now, modern rabbis, many of whom will say that Judaism doesn't really talk about the afterlife, which is, by the way, completely untrue. Modern Judaism doesn't talk about the afterlife. But medieval and ancient Judaism, frankly, couldn't keep quiet about the afterlife and talked about it all the time, okay? Modern rabbis will point to this and say, you see, Judaism concentrates on this world. What they won't do is quote the next thing that is in Pirkei Avot, which reads as follows. This world is like a vestibule, or the previous, rather, the vestibule before the world to come. Prepare yourself in the vestibule so that you may enter the banquet hall. In other words, this world is just a preparation for the world to come, which is what Rabbi Yaakov goes on to say, that better is eternity in the world to come. So, one of the things that I want to establish at the beginning is when you say, what does Judaism say about the afterlife? The answer is everything. Yes, no, maybe. It's great. We're not sure we want to get there. This life is what matters. The next life is what matters. You can find a source. It's what Levi Ginsberg, who was a great scholar of the Midrash, used to say. He said, you know, there's an old phrase that the devil could quote scripture to his purpose. That means that the Bible has so much in it that if you want to quote it for good, you can quote it for good. If you want to quote it for bad, you can quote it for bad. So Levi Ginsberg used to say the devil can quote scripture to his purpose, and if he were more learned, he could quote the Talmud too, right? Because in rabbinic literature, there's also stuff that is all across the board. But what I'm going to argue this morning is that, in fact, a general picture does emerge for what Judaism believes as a whole, even though I don't want to pretend that Judaism speaks with one voice on this or just about any other question, but certainly not on this one. When you come to the rabbinic period and in the Bible, as we said last week, you already know that the idea of an afterlife exists. And the reason you know it exists is because the Jews had an experience in Egypt. And Egypt is a society built around the afterlife. Mummies, pyramids, it's all about what happens after you die, right? All the graves. There's a city in Egypt, the city of the dead, which is this giant mausoleum that suggests that people live on after they die. And also, it's impossible. It's just impossible if you've ever gone to a funeral and you've ever seen someone lowered in the ground, it is impossible not to think about what happens to them after they die. You can't do it. I mean, you may not want to, but you can't help but think, does this person still live on? How does this person still live on? And that was apparently true in prehistory, which is why, as I mentioned last week, you find even Neanderthal graves, they found like the DNA of pollen in them, which suggests they were buried with flowers. The idea is that from early on, death was this great mystery, and people wondered what was on the other side of the river Styx, which was how the Greeks thought of it. You know, you go across the river and you end up on the other side. The rabbis talked, first of all, since the Bible says that every human being is in B'Tselem Elohim, every human being is in the image of God, and God is by definition eternal, the rabbis assumed that human beings have that within them which is eternal. And in fact, it seems as though, this is at least true according to Josephus, the rabbis believed in an afterlife and the Sadducees, the priestly class, didn't. Okay, which may in fact be true and is explained by some people as the priestly class had a good life and the rabbis came from the lower classes and didn't have such a good life, and you're more likely to believe that this world is all that matters if this world treats you well. Right? If this world is miserable, you want to think there's another world. If you're doing well in this world, so, you know, then you want to, then it's not so unfair, because it isn't only the suffering, it's the essential unfairness of somebody who's a miserable human being, who's cruel, who's and lives well, and someone else who's kind and good and lives a life full of suffering, right? As the book of Job puts it, the evil man who dies, this is a great image, I love this image, with his pails full of milk, right? In other words, everything is wonderful for him. And that essential injustice really rankles, really pains you much more if your life is miserable. And the rabbis, many of whom came from the lower classes and many of whom led very difficult lives, they were convinced that a belief in God entails a belief in the afterlife, because God would not abandon you when you die. And that in some ways, to deny the afterlife is equivalent to denying God. So you get, for in rabbinic works, for example, when you study Pirkei Avot, which I mentioned before, before you sit down to study it, there's a short formula that you're supposed to say, which ends with Kol Yisrael Yesh Lahem Chelek Ba'olam Haba. All of Israel has a portion in the world to come. And you say that over and over and over and over and over again, because the rabbis were convinced that the world to come was real. And all over the Talmud you get, if you do this, you lose your portion in the world to come. If you do that, you gain your portion in the world to come. Which I don't think, and I think that no Talmudic scholar thinks it was supposed to be taken literally. They weren't saying, you know, if you do this, you literally lose your portion in the world to come. It was so everyday to them that it was a way of saying that's a bad thing, right? There were two theories. The whole world to come and getting the world to come, just as an aside, becomes complicated. Because if you want to motivate people to get their portion in the world to come, you want to also motivate bad people. So you can't say, live a lifetime of goodness and you get the world to come. Because then somebody who's been bad is going to give up the possibility of being good. So the rabbis insisted that some people get the world to come through a lifetime of goodness, but some kone et olamo bevat echad. In one instant, they get their portion in the world to come. And the example they give, which is morally problematic, but you can understand why from a motivational point of view it works, is, you know, Hananiah ben Tiradion was being tortured by the Romans, right? This is one of the people that we talk about on Yom Kippur. He's being tortured by the Romans. They wrapped him up in a Torah scroll and set him on fire. But what they did was they put wet cotton in the scroll so that it would die, it would go slowly. So he would be tortured to death. And he asked the Roman guard who was guarding him to basically ensure that the fire would engulf him all at once so he wouldn't suffer. To which the Roman guard said, "Will you ensure a place for me in the world to come?" This is a Roman guard. You can't get more evil, right, in the context of the rabbis, than a Roman guard. And Rabbi Hananiah ben Tiradion says, yes, he does it. They both die, and a bat kol comes from heaven. A bat kol is a voice of God that says that they've arrived in heaven. Okay? So now, there's a lot of discussion about that story. A lot of discussion. As you can imagine, some rabbis are very uncomfortable with it. And, you know, who knows? Maybe this was a particularly nice Roman guard. Maybe he didn't lead such a bad life. But the idea of the world to come as a reward is a central and important notion in rabbinic literature, okay? So now if you ask what is the world to come, there you're on much touchier ground, because even though in the Middle Ages, if any of you have ever read Dante, you know that Dante takes a tour, first of all, through the Inferno is through hell, right? And then he goes through limbo, and then Paradiso is through paradise. And everybody who reads that poem, from Dante's earliest readers, and Dante was one of those people who, I mean, people were awed by his genius from the moment that the poem was first read. It didn't get bad reviews and then later become a masterpiece, like, say, Moby Dick. But everyone said that Dante's Paradiso was not as effective as his Inferno. Right? And even today, you know, when people say, have you read Dante, they're always talking about hell, never about heaven. Because depicting human torment is much easier, and the drama is much more powerful than depicting felicity, depicting paradise. In fact, I can predict with much greater accuracy what will give everybody in this room pain than I can what will give everybody in this room pleasure. Right? I don't know what you like, but I have a pretty good guess what you dislike. Which is why, as Jews, we always like Hillel's principle better than Jesus's, right? Jesus is, do unto others what you would have them do unto you. And the problem with that is what George Bernard Shaw said, which is, you shouldn't follow that rule because their tastes may not be the same, But what Hillel said is, don't do to someone else what is hateful to you. Which is, and he said it, by the way, at least 60 years before Jesus was born, probably more. Which is a more accurate principle because you can predict better what someone else is going to hate. Now, why did I say all this? Because the rabbis generally avoided a description of what heaven was like, right? In fact, Mark Twain has in his book Letters from Earth that people think when they get to heaven they're going to lie on green fields and listen to harp music. He says they wouldn't want to do it for 5 minutes while they're alive, but they think after they die they'll be happy for all of eternity doing this. So they talked about not heaven but Olam Haba, the world to come. Okay? And the world to come, for the rabbis, you know what the most common description of the world to come is? The most common description of the world to come is you sit and study with God. Because for the rabbis, study was the greatest pleasure, and studying with God, what could be better, right? That's why in his book on the canon of Judaism, on the books of Judaism, Moshe Halbertal says that his Talmud teacher used to say to him that heaven and hell are the same place. And for those who love study, it's heaven. And for those who can't stand it, it's hell, right? But that's the rabbis pictured it that way because that's who they were, right? To study with God, to learn with God, this is nothing could be better. But, and so they call it Yeshiva Shamala, right? The yeshiva, the school of study on high. But the reality is that not everybody's idea of, you know, heaven is riding around with the teaching company, right, blaring through their heavenly speakers. And so there isn't this detailed description of what heaven is that you get in Christian sources and even more in Islamic sources. Now, when the medieval time came and Dante and others were doing these tours of heaven and hell, Jews did it too. Right? Jews do have Jewish scholars who travel through heaven and who travel through hell, and I'm going to come to hell in just a second. But it was not nearly as prevalent as in Christianity and Islam because the rabbis didn't really give much warrant for it. If, though, heaven is supposed to be a redress, that is, a correction for all the injustices of this world, then you got to have punishment too. You have to. Because there are people who deserve to be punished. And the idea that someone, you know, there's a famous story from the Nuremberg trials where a Catholic priest wanted Eichmann. And again, I mean, in the annals of human wickedness, Eichmann, who is the only person, by the way, that Israel ever put to death, right, in all of its history, Eichmann is about as bad as you get. Okay, Stalin, Hitler, Mao, there are a couple worse, but not much. So this Catholic priest came before the tribunal and asked if he could speak to Eichmann the night before to get him to accept Jesus before he died. So one of the judges asked, does that mean that according to your theology, Eichmann, if he accepts Jesus, will go to heaven and all the people he killed will go to hell? To which he answers yes. And the reason behind it, you have to understand why the classical Christian theology thinks that default from the beginning, because of original sin, every human being deserves to go to hell. That's just, you can't be good enough to go to heaven. That's the whole premise behind original sin. Right? However, Jesus came to give grace to those who accept Jesus so that they can get to heaven even though they don't deserve it through grace. Okay? Which means that it doesn't matter how wicked you are, if you accept grace, you get to go, and it doesn't matter how good you are, you're still not good enough to go if you don't accept Jesus, all right? Now, in Judaism, obviously, it doesn't work that way because you've got the principle in the morning prayers. I promise I'll take questions at the end, but I want to get through as much as I can of this because I'm already against the clock. In Judaism, remember, in the morning prayers, you say, Elohai neshama shenatata bi tahorahi. God, the soul you've given me is pure. Why do you say that every morning? It's a way of saying, I am not a victim of original sin, right? We don't believe in that. We believe that your soul starts pure, and then what you do with it, subject to all the influences in your life, is your choice. But if you're bad enough, we need a punishment just as Christianity does. The idea of eternal torment does not exist in the Hebrew Bible. Okay? This is why if you're ever arguing with a Christian about which Bible is kinder than the other, we win hands down. Right? Because nothing is worse than eternal torment. And we don't have that, and they do. In fact, Rabbi Akiva says explicitly that the maximum punishment that someone receives after death is 12 months. He literally says 12 months, which is why, although you may not know this, you say Kaddish for your parents for 11 months, right? You say Kaddish for 11 months because Kaddish is supposed to speed the soul on its journey to its ultimate destination in Olam Haba. Now, let's say your parents are wicked people. Then they're being punished. If they're punished for 12 months, that means that they're of maximum wickedness. And no, the tradition doesn't want any child to say of their parents that they would deserve the maximum punishment, so you say it for 11 months, okay? So even built into the structure of the Kaddish is the idea both of punishment and of punishments not being eternal. What the punishment is, I don't know. But if you've ever been in severe pain, you know, two hours can be a long time. 11 months, you know, that's enough to atone for an awful lot of sins. The idea, though, that the soul exists in another world and not in this one is in some ways a painful idea. And the notion of resurrection, of what Kabbalah calls Gilgul, which is a circle, right, came into Judaism probably in the high Middle Ages, but you don't find it in classical Jewish sources, even though, again, every Jew who makes every statement tries to find support in the Bible and the Talmud. So the fact that you don't find it there doesn't mean that people don't find it there, right? The fact that, or I should say it this way, the fact that it doesn't exist there doesn't mean that no one will find it there, right? I can find things in the Bible that don't exist very easily. People do it every day. But the idea of reincarnation became popular really later. Earlier than that is the idea of resurrection. Resurrection is, in fact, in the Bible, and I will read you what's called the Locus Classicus, that is, the place where it's clearly stated, and that's Daniel chapter 12. Let's see, where we go. All right. At that time, the great prince Michael, some of you may know that from the prayer, right? Mimini Michael, at my right hand, the angel Michael, who stands beside the sons of your people will appear. It will be a time of trouble, the like of which has never been seen since the nation came into being. At that time, your people will be rescued, but all who are found inscribed in the book, many of those that sleep in the dust of the earth will awake, some to eternal life, others to reproaches, to everlasting abhorrence. Okay? There's where you get the everlasting abhorrence idea, though he doesn't say exactly what that means or that it's punishment for not believing. The idea of resurrection in Daniel is tied clearly to a messianic time. So let me just say a couple words about the Messiah. I won't have time to do as much about the Messiah as I'd like, but let me say a couple words. There are two fundamental ideas about the Messiah in Jewish tradition. One is a supernatural idea and one is a natural idea. The natural idea is that when the Messiah comes, the world isn't going to fundamentally change. It'll be the same world as now, but it'll be a better place, right? Maimonides says, when it says the lion will lay down with the lamb, it means big nations and small nations will get along. It doesn't mean literally lions will lay down with lambs, right? And that's Maimonides talking. You can't get more authoritative than Maimonides, okay? Woody Allen says the same thing, by the way. He says, the lion may lay down with the lamb, but one of them isn't going to get much sleep. So he agrees with Maimonides, right? But there are also, which is why, by the way, if you look in the Talmud, Rabbi Akiva, and again, you can't get more authoritative than Rabbi Akiva, thought that Bar Kochba might be the Messiah. Right? Rabbi Akiva thought that Bar Kochba might be the Messiah because Bar Kochba was a military leader. Not because he worked, you know, supernatural miracles. And Rabbi Yoshua ben Torta, whom I don't know anything else about. I don't know if he's mentioned another time in the Talmud. But this just goes to show you, you can be the smartest, wisest person and be completely wrong, and someone who is much less smart and much less wise can be totally right. Rabbi Yeshua ben Torta said, Rabbi Akiva, grass will grow from your cheeks and the Messiah will not have come. In other words, you'll be dead and buried and we still won't have the Messiah. Right? And Rabbi Akiva may have been a greater scholar and a greater man, but he was wrong. So the idea for Rabbi Akiva was what Shmuel says in the Talmud. Ein bein olam hazeh v'yimot ha-mashiach ela shi'ubud malchuyot bilvad, which means there's no difference between our time and the time of the Messiah, except in the time of the Messiah we will no longer be ruled by the nations. Once Jews rule themselves, according to Shmuel, which shows you how much they hated Rome, once Jews rule themselves, that's the time of the Messiah. Right? He wasn't talking supernaturally. He didn't believe that the whole order of the world would change. He didn't think there would be a resurrection of the dead when the Messiah came. It's just that the Jewish people will have political liberation, which means, by the way, that in some ways we are living in messianic times. You know that. So, for what it's worth. Now, there are others, many, many others in Jewish history, many other authorities in the Talmud, by the way, as well as outside the Talmud. And in fact, if you look at the Talmud at the end of Sanhedrin, there are all these messianic speculations, and they all contradict each other, which means that the rabbis weren't convinced what would happen when the Messiah came. But the prevailing picture is it's going to be a terrible time. Parents and children will be set at odds. People will forget Torah. In other words, there's going to be some cataclysm. They call it Chevlei HaMashiach, the birth pangs of the Messiah. Terrible things will happen before the Messiah is born. And out of this terrible tumult and fighting and so on, you'll get a Messiah, which is why several of the rabbis in the Talmud say, may the Messiah come and may I not live to see it. Because they assume it's going to be an awful time. Which is why every time in history there's been an awful time, right? Every time, the Inquisitions, the Crusades, the Chalnitsky pogroms, on and on and on, you get a spike in messianic speculation, right? When things that are bad are happening, people think, ah, this is what's going to finally give birth to a new world. So the idea that it's supernatural leads people to believe that the Messiah will lead to the resurrection of people who deserve to be resurrected. And the reason that people want to live in Israel is that when the resurrection happens, people are supposed to be resurrected and travel to the land of Israel. And if you're there, you're already there, right? The LAX is going to be So you'll be magically transported to Israel, and there everybody will live. And that idea that the resurrection is a supernatural event was also used, as you can imagine, in different ways as a trope of revenge. That is, Abravanel, about whom I did a lot of work in rabbinical school, is a fascinating and wonderful character in a lot of ways. And by the way, the best biography of Abravanel was written by a scholar named Netanyahu. Bibi Netanyahu and Yehonatan Netanyahu's father wrote a book about Abravanel. Abravanel believed that when the Messiah came, Israel would take revenge on its enemies. Now, if you ask why was Abravanel so angry, the answer is because he lived at the generation of the Inquisition. He was an advisor to Ferdinand and Isabella. There was a plot to kidnap his grandson so that he wouldn't leave the country and he would convert and stay there. That's how valued he was. But he chose, which is his heroism and part of the reason why he's a hero in Jewish history, he chose to leave a very comfortable and good life and to go into exile with the Jewish people, which is why, and I remember, I will tell you a very quick story. When I decided to do my paper on Abravanel, so I went to Benjamin Gampel, who's a professor at the Jewish Theological Seminary, wonderful guy, great history teacher, and very funny man. And I told him that I wanted to do the paper on Abravanel. I said, because he's so heroic, he didn't have to leave. And he went, and he travels to Portugal, and here's this guy who goes there. And Gampel said, you know, this is, to me, I've always been interested in everyone else. He says, because you figure Bravanel gets off the boat and everybody surrounds him and it's a Bravanel and he's wonderful. He says, but what about all these other people who left? And I think that it's actually the vision of all those other people that makes a Bravanel want revenge. You know, he was on the boat with all these people whose lives were completely shattered, who didn't have the resources he did to study and to teach and to be famous and all of that. And so he wrote a couple books of messianic speculation where he says that Israel will take revenge on its enemies when the Messiah comes. But Maimonides says the opposite. Maimonides says specifically, and Maimonides, by the way, lived a couple hundred years before Abravanel, he says specifically the Messiah will not come so that Israel can take revenge on its enemies, but so that everyone will seek knowledge of God. And since Israel will have the greatest knowledge of God, people will come to us to learn. And he ends his great code of Jewish law by his vision of the Messianic days, which he says that the knowledge of the Lord will spread over the earth as the waters cover the sea. That's what he thinks of as the Messianic time, right? Which is, which is unbelievable, nothing less than that, for a Jew who was kicked out of his home by persecution, by the Almohad persecution, and lived in Fostat in Cairo in the 13th century. But that was Maimonides. Okay, so that's a very quick praises of the coming of the Messiah. There are, by the way, two messiahs that are mentioned in rabbinic literature. This is interesting. Most Mashiach ben David is the one that we always know and talk about. There's also a Mashiach ben Yosef, who is supposed to die in battle. So the idea that a Messiah will die, right, and that a messianic figure will die was an idea that was current in rabbinic times, right? We can talk much more about how some of these ideas influence Christianity, but that's a separate conversation, so I'm going to leave it for the moment and get to reincarnation. Reincarnation. So reincarnation is essentially, I mean, you all know what the idea is. The idea is that you die and then you return to this world. It is among the great religious ideas, the only one that I think it's fair to say that I really detest. I hate the idea of reincarnation, and I'll tell you why. Because reincarnation is premised on the notion that you come back as what you are supposed to come back as. That is, if you lead a bad life, you'll come back in a degraded state. If you lead a good life, then you'll come back in a better state, right, to move on to a still higher state. But however you come back to this world is entirely dependent on the life you lived in your previous world, which means that the way people are born in this world is fair, because it's entirely based on what they did before. And the notion that this world is fair seems to me an obscene notion. And I've had this debate with many people who believe in reincarnation. They've all tried to convince me that it's not, that isn't what it means, but they haven't even come close. And the reason they haven't is because in societies where reincarnation is taken seriously, like in India, you have untouchables. And why are they untouchable? Because in a previous, and nobody feels bad about it. Why should I feel bad about it? After all, they're untouchable because in a previous life, they did bad things. Never mind the fact, by the way, that I don't know where you get all the souls, since there are billions of people in the world today, right? And in the time of the Bible, there were only, a few hundred thousand or a million or a couple million. So forget the fact that there's been a radical expansion in the number of souls. But even if you could work out the math, because I think applying mathematical concepts to spiritual concepts is kind of silly in the first place, I have a very hard time with it. Now that I've announced my hard time, let me just say a little bit about it, which is the part of the motivation behind reincarnation is a sort of law of conservation of spirit. There is a passage, for example, that we often read at funerals, that when a wise person dies, how do you compensate for that loss? I mean, think about it. You know, somebody dies whose head is full of wisdom and knowledge and so on, and it's all gone from the world. And the idea that a spirit wouldn't be lost, that somehow it would get put back into the world, is a very powerful idea. And you may know that, by the way, among the Kabbalists, as among other traditions, reincarnation wasn't only into human beings. Right? Reincarnation was into animals and even into insects. So this idea was that life, there's a certain quantity of life, and it gets reborn and rebuilt. And one of the One of the skills of great Hasidic masters was they were supposed to be able to look into your eyes and tell you who you were in a previous life. Okay. We don't have time anyway, want to debate the idea of reincarnation. You'll have to decide whether it is true that people have memories of past lives, whether they have skills that they couldn't have acquired another way. That's what the book Many Lives, Many Masters is about, right? He's a psychologist or a psychiatrist, and he's analyzing somebody who miraculously remembers past lives that gradually come out over the course of the book. But the idea does exist in Judaism, along with the idea of physical bodily resurrection, and I want to say a couple words about resurrection, and then I'll take questions. Resurrection, even though it's attested to, as I read you in the book of Daniel, resurrection is much harder to believe in some ways than the continuation of the soul, right? Because the soul is immaterial. But resurrection is a beautiful idea in two different ways. First of all, we don't know what a human being is without a body. Our only experience of human beings are human beings with bodies. And not only that, but there is an integration between body and soul in every human being. There's a beautiful midrash which talks about the integration of body and soul. It says that once a man had an orchard, and he had beautiful ripe apples, and there was a blind man and a lame man. And the lame man said to the blind man, you know, across the field there are apples. I can't walk there because I'm lame, and you don't know where it is because you're blind. Put me on your shoulders, I'll tell you where to go, and together we'll steal the apples. And they do, and then they come before the court. And one of them says, I didn't steal the apples, I'm blind. And the other one says, I didn't steal the apples, I'm lame. And the judge said, the two of you together stole the apples. And God says the same thing to the person when they come up before the heavenly court. The body says, I have no spirit. I couldn't do anything by itself. And the soul says, I don't have the physical attributes to do anything. And God says, no, the two of you work together in this world. So first of all, we don't know what it is not to have a body in this world. But even more powerfully, resurrection affirms the goodness of having a body. There are religious traditions that think that the body is bad, right? Essentially bad. But Judaism doesn't believe that. Judaism believes that the body can be sanctified and can be good, and that to have a body is not a bad thing. It's a good thing. Right? So it's not just that you have this beautiful, pure soul inside of this dirty crust of a body, but in fact that God doesn't create things that aren't potentially sanctifiable and beautiful, and so having a body is good, and when you're in your perfect state of resurrection, you'll have a body, which is a really nice idea. So resurrection, reincarnation, the soul living on in another world, and the Messiah somehow sparking the process of resurrection, all of those ideas exist in the Jewish tradition. Now let me just close before I ask for questions with this. To me, the hardest, in some ways, the core of belief, in some ways, the core of my belief, I'll put it that way, is not in God but in human beings. And by that I mean, when my faith in God flags, right, when it gets weaker, when I get worried, I think about the fact that I cannot believe that human beings disappear. I really think that if you know someone, care for someone, you look in someone's eyes, you pay attention to them, that you can't believe that this is just a collection of chemicals, that there is something more. And in some ways, at times, my belief goes upward instead of coming downward. That is, from seeing an image of God in human beings, I'm able more to believe in God. Even though, and by the way, evil doesn't change this. Because the whole point is, the reason we hate evil in human beings so much is because they violate the spirit of God in them, right? I mean, if a lion kills a man, or a person kills a man, only one of them is morally evil. It's the one who violates the spirit of God in him. The other one's just acting like a beast, and that's what beasts do. So If you believe in God, or you believe in God and human beings, then it's impossible to believe that there isn't a life after this one. What that life is, I have absolutely no idea. But I'm not terribly concerned about it in a certain way, because I couldn't have imagined this life before I came into it either, right? And any imagination I would have had would have been completely impoverished next to what's here. Who would have been able to imagine mountains and tuna fish and eyes and voices and books and lakes and all of it? I mean, the world is infinitely richer than anything we could ever have dreamed of. Not only is it infinitely richer, but it would be way beyond our imagination to think that there was such a world. You know, Mark Twain is right. When you try to imagine such a world, it's like reading science fiction. Science fiction can be very creative, but it is always built of the blocks of things we already know. Because we can't imagine that which we have no experience of whatsoever. So the creatures are made of light. That's because we know light, or they're made of intellect. But I wouldn't even have the words to communicate to you a world that was different from this world, right? How would I describe it if there's no world in this world? So in that sense, I deeply believe in something else and have no idea what it is. And the parable that I always close with, which I will again today, is from Tukhachinsky's book, Gesher HaChaim. This rabbi writes a book about all the laws of mourning. And he begins it by saying that you have to imagine twins in a womb. And there's a child in the womb who believes in a world outside the womb, and the other one doesn't. He said, now imagine they're arguing. And the one who believes in it says, there's no world outside here. You're ridiculous. That's crazy. We've never seen another world. We've never experienced another world. How could you believe that? And the other one says, I don't know. I just have this sense that there's another world. Now he says, imagine the one who believes is born. Back in the womb, his brother is mourning a death. But outside, they're celebrating a life. He said, that's what happens when you die. Everybody back in the world, since they don't know another world, they assume that you died. He says, but there is another world in which everybody is celebrating a birth. And from the earliest hints in the Bible, to Talmudic literature, to medieval literature, to modern literature, if you believe that there is something eternal in human beings, then whatever that is, when it dies in this world, must be reborn in another. And one hopes that that is true. And though I wanted to leave you with that, I will leave you with the slightly cynical words of Cicero, the ancient Roman orator, who once said, who believed in a life after death, and was arguing with a philosophical cynic who didn't believe it. And Cicero said to him, all I know is that if I am right, I will laugh one day at you. And if you are right, you will never laugh at me. So questions, comments. Thank you. Okay, we only have a few minutes. Yes? No? Okay. Yes. Right.
Maybe without knowing it, that's what they were referring to. In other words, like if life is constantly being created, and there's you and your universe and what you believe in, and me and what I believe in, and then the universe that we all share, nobody can know what's in our minds and in our hearts or whatever. If we're constantly creating by our thoughts and our words and our deeds, is that not making...
Okay, there are a couple things I want to say, but first I want to just remind you. The books that we talked about, if you're interested, are The Death of Death by Neil Gilman, Jewish Views of the Afterlife by Simcha Paul Raphael, and also Does the Soul Survive by Elie Spitz. And also on Sunday, we're giving out flu shots for those of you who are interested, probably here in Gold Hall, because you also want to live in this life. Dr. Heckmott is doing that for a donation to Chazon Yeshayahu, the soup kitchen in Israel. Also, remember, not this weekend, but next weekend, is Chancellor Arnold Eisen, the Chancellor of the Jewish Theological Seminary, is going to be our scholar in residence speaking about the future of American Judaism. Okay. All I would say is any theology of karma that tells you that you get what you give in this world, that there is a cycle that always comes back to you, seems to me radically flawed. because the answer is sometimes karma works and sometimes it doesn't. And there are people who put out goodness in this world and get evil back, and vice versa. And I don't want, the reason that I don't want to teach that is because I don't want anyone to make their goodness dependent on getting something back. In fact, that's explicitly what it says in the Talmud. There's a great dialogue in the Talmud about whether there's reward for mitzvot in this world, and explicitly says in this world. Next world is another question. And they argue about it back and forth. Are there reward for mitzvot in this world? And they give examples of people in the Bible who did mitzvot that they were not rewarded, and they end the discussion, which is pretty rare in the Talmud, with Tiufta, I think it's Rabbi Yochanan, I don't remember, Rabbi Yochanan Tiufta, which means he has been decisively refuted. In other words, the Talmud concludes without question, there is not reward for mitzvot in this world. And you could, you know, I mean, it's what, there are a lot of examples, we have too many, so I would say yes, you are constantly creating, but you're not constantly getting back what you create. Sometimes you get back much better, sometimes worse, and it's very uneven, sometimes what you deserve. Yeah.
Two questions, if I could. One is there any thought on the notion of reunion with relatives or loved ones who've passed on? And the other is, does Judaism say anything about the difference between the soul and the mind? That is, if I go on, soul goes on, what that means my memory.
So the answer to the second is the soul is basically considered the entire personality. They assume that people live on the same way that they lived here. And there is... And whether you get to know in the world to come, the answer is there are many, many, many folk traditions that assume that people live on in other worlds. And there were even people who prayed to those who died and asked them for intervention, as people tend to do today when they go to graves. One of the interesting things, at least in Judaism, it never took away the sense of being missed here. That is, when Rava dies in the Talmud, his students don't know the answer to some law, and they say, "Look, he died, and we haven't even gotten the answer to this law from him." So they still feel his absence. But yes, there is the assumption that eventually, I mean, when you don't know the answer, remember, when you don't know the answer to a Talmudic question in the Talmud, they say teku, which means tishbi yitarech kushyotu bayot. The tishbite, who's the tishbite? Elijah will come back and answer all of our difficulties. In other words, one day, you know, we'll know all this and the minds will still be operative. Yeah, go ahead. Okay, make them quick because I've only got a couple minutes.
Okay, is there a few that this is it, there's nothing after this life?
And second?
Is the Messiah something that's from the Bible or developed after?
Okay, so the answer to the first is there's a view that this is it, that there's nothing else in this life, but it's clearly not the rabbinic view. I mean, there are Jews who believe that, but it's not the rabbinic view. And the Messiah is certainly mentioned in the Bible, although not supernaturally. The supernatural Messiah developed mostly after the Bible. Yes, last question.
Yeah. Put out out-of-body experiences,
right.
Which kind of tells you that the soul lives
on. Okay, so out-of-body experiences, you know, Moody and Elizabeth Kubler-Ross have written about this. It tells you one of two things. It either tells you that the mind is infinitely more complex than we know and does things that we're not aware of and makes people experience things that they're not in fact experiencing, or it tells you that the soul lives on. And it's not just out-of-body experiences, of course, but also I think you're alluding to death experiences, people who die and then are revived. You know, if you ask a materialist, they will say, this is obviously a trick of the mind of some chemical reaction in the mind that happens when people die, and that's just what it is. And then it all goes blank. But I'm with you. Yeah.
Was there a theological context for the phrase char mitzvah, the reward for a mitzvah, the mitzvah itself?
So the question is there a theological context for the idea that the reward of a mitzvah is a mitzvah instead of the reward of a mitzvah is, you know, you get stuff? My guess is there's a social context and a theological context. You know, for example, think of the Holocaust, all right, but any suffering in history, it's clear that you're not getting rewarded for your mitzvot. It's just clear, right? So you get theologies like God is suffering with us, there's reward in the next life, but not in this life. And that same, and the only time that you get people, I once put it this way, you know, talking about a book that Shirley MacLaine had mass produced, that people who think that you make your own luck in this world are lucky, are people who are lucky people, right? But unlucky people know better. It's very easy to believe in Beverly Hills that you make your own luck, right? Seriously. But it's not so easy to believe if you're born in a relocation camp in the Sudan. Okay, then it's hard to believe that you make your own luck in this world and that karma really brings back to you everything you put out. Right? And the theological context, I think, is that what I said before, that really the point of doing, if God tells you to do a mitzvah and you only do it because you're going to get stuff, it's a very low level of theology. It's what Yeshayahu Leibovitz had a really nice analysis of the Shema. He says the lowest level of the Shema is V'haya im Shamoa, the second paragraph, where it says basically, if you're good, you get rewarded. If you're bad, you get punished. Right? A higher level is you need these reminders to love God. You need the tzitzit. You love God, but you know you slip. And the highest level is just V'ahavta et Hashem Elokecha. You just love the Lord your God. It doesn't matter whether that love brings you joy or it brings you sadness.